Well, the tongue is a fire in the very world of iniquity. So, I tell you, we got a tough transition into that with the way we're talking. Chapter 3. Chapter 3. Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we will incur a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, if we put the bits into the horses' mouths so that they will obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Look at the ships also. Though they are so great and are driven by strong winds, are still directed by a very small rudder wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue is a very small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. Hi, Leslie. So this, along with the remaining seven verses of this first half of the chapter, is about the tongue. And this one really is breaks the part we just read, breaks into two parts. The first is a warning to those who would be teachers, and the warning is addressed to Christians broadly. It says, let not many of you become teachers, my brethren. So it's addressed to Christians. It's just generally addressed to the congregation. And it's a warning about, you know, an exhortation, a caution about becoming teachers.
Is that where they start at Dallas?
Yeah, that's a good one. That is a good one. Well, I think that's
serious. It seems like a good place to start.
I think that's probably what they do at graduation. They say, okay, as you're coming up, some of you get a diploma and some of you get this verse, and they just hand you that verse and you kind of exit to the right. Go backstage. That's a good one. I like that. That would be kind of, they have this one that when they built one building, which kind of changed the front of the, you know, the seminary, the official address of the seminary faces Swiss Street, which was a very popular street a long time ago. And as you go a little ways from the seminary, there's some really big houses and stuff, and so it's kind of a prestigious address at one time. And the other side of the seminary, Live Oak, is the more major thoroughfare now. And so when they added some buildings, that, you know, became really the front of the building for all purposes. And the motto of the seminary is preach the word. And so there's a stone, you know, carving on facing the inside of the campus is that, and on the outside there's a verse about it's out of Colossians, which one is it? I can't remember. Becoming like Christ or something. I forget exactly what it is, but that, maybe that instead of preach the word, maybe this would be a better passage for a seminary, you know. Just the warning. The question really becomes why the warning? Let not many of you become teachers. Goes on to talk about tongue, so we can make some association with tongue, and he clearly says that, you know, it has to do with judgment. But why the warning about being the teacher? And it's not addressed, you know, specifically to leaders or this. It's addressed to Christians. You know, this is one of these passages that leaves us kind of wanting a little more, James, exactly who we were talking to, what, you know, that. But I guess some general things we can draw from it is, as we look at it as well. One is just the general, as he'll move on, and because it's, you know, he has the exhortation, but he also, there's a general principle here, because he says, knowing that, so it seems, you know, he's speaking as though it's generally understood. People generally know this, and And the reason is there is this stricter judgment. It says, we will incur a stricter judgment. So the teacher, so, but it may be in the sense that there was a little bit of a rush to be a teacher. And, you know, where in other passages such as Paul, somewhat in John, where there's the be careful about those that teach false doctrine. And you got to be careful about people coming in that teach things that are wrong. This doesn't seem to be a focus here, but maybe it's in the sense of, you know, carelessness or just not being qualified, being too eager to teach, people wanting to be teachers for whatever reason, whether that's just kind of generally or whether people wanted a certain position or prestige or, you know, whatever that might be at times. But then given the whole passage, it also seems to be connected with that in terms of that position influences people, so you need to be careful about being too quick to step into that position if you're not prepared, if you're not qualified, if you don't, you know, have some of that aspect under control. Whatever those situations, and maybe it has to do, as it'll look a little bit later, also with the, you know, just the message, you know, one's lifestyle fitting the message, those kinds of things, you know, he clearly gives this exhortation, which is a little different than what we often hear, you know, because we're, you know, especially in the last, I don't know, 25 years, 30 years, there's been such a, probably a little more than that, 35, 40 now, such an emphasis generally on spiritual gifts, being involved in ministry. And so it would be that, you know, do you have the gift of teaching, get involved? Well, I don't think we should say, you know, don't. But here is just that caution, just like Rob asked about seminary. I don't think anybody's necessarily asking this question that way, and that's a pretty good one.
On this day and age, you know, anybody can write a book.
True.
And I deal with clients all the time that are constantly writing books about spiritual things.
Mm-hmm. And the internet's made, you know, that kind of stuff even more accessible, because you don't even have to have an editor approve it anymore. And yeah. And so this would be I hadn't thought about that as an application. This would be a really good application for internet, as people have set up all of these internet sites for that are basically teaching. I mean, they, you know, given the benefit of the doubt, they have good intention. And yet, you know, maybe these things should be thought about at times. James thinks so. So he says, let not many of you become teachers. And it's generally understood, he says, my brethren, knowing that. So it's generally people, he's taking this as a general statement that people understand this, that teachers will have a stricter judgment. That is, you know, in sense of degree in Romans 14, we have something that's kind of related. He says, 14:10, but you, why do you judge your brother? Or you again, why do you regard your brother with contempt? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall give praise to God. So then each one of you, of us shall give an account of himself to God. So there's that sense of judgment, even that sense of stricter judgment. So why are we setting in judgment of some others when we, you know, are in that sense of judgment? Well, there are some other passage related to that same type of judging. You know, so it's not unique here. But there seems to be a judging based upon the impact that we have on others. That seems to be what he's looking at here. As you impact other people's lives, you will incur a stricter judgment. And so obviously that's not as you impact them positively, but as you're teaching, you know, has that negative impact. He moves from there, and there's a kind of a general acknowledgement that we all struggle. He says, "For we all stumble in many ways." And so he seems, you know, there seems to be this sense of here, you know, since we all trip, since we all, you know, stumble on something, you know, you really need to be careful if you want to take on that role of teaching. Because everybody's going to stumble. Everybody's going to trip. Nobody's perfect. Nobody's going to do anything perfectly. So if you don't think about that, he's saying. So, I mean, I don't think we want to push a passage like this to the point where, oh, you shouldn't be a teacher, because that's not what James is saying. But there apparently is kind of a rush to be a teacher, you know, in what he's talking about, without thinking about the responsibility, without thinking about the real impact that it can have, and whether that impact is positive or negative. From there, you know, it takes a, this last phrase becomes a moving into almost say, you know, he's made this statement about the tongue. He says, "For we all stumble in many ways." I mean, that idea of stumbling, and he uses that as he moves forward into this sense of the tongue can be a very difficult thing to handle. The tongue can be a very difficult thing to control, and so that connection with teaching. So if obviously, if one is teaching, there's a use of a tongue, and if you're not careful, there's a negative side of that. So he begins in the middle of verse 2 for the second part. He says, "If anyone does not stumble in what he says," well, he's already said we all stumble, so generally speaking, we all stumble. Now it becomes very specifically, if anyone does not stumble in what he says. Anybody here fit that category? Not today.
I would, but if I said something about it.
He's kind of like that humility is so hard, because if you tell anybody you're humble, you lost it, huh?
If you try to measure the location of a particle, an atomic, subatomic particle, it changes where it is.
So he says, if anyone does not stumble in what he does, he is a perfect man. Perfect here, not in the sense of sinless necessarily, but in that, you know, he would be, you know, that really mature person. And so the stumble here is not, you know, it's not that absolute perfection he's not talking about. But if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. He's a mature man, able to bridle the whole body's will. So, there's, you know, in one sense, I think, you know, you could probably say James is making a little bit of an overstatement here. But his focus is about the tongue. And, you know, you can go back, you know, Jesus put some emphasis here. It's, you know, what comes out, you know. And you know, even that, you can say, you know, well, is that totally, you know, would that be consistent everywhere? Well, obviously what goes in matters. But you know, there's a context. And so as you're looking at this context and trying to make, you know, communicate, James is saying, if you're able to control your tongue, then there is a self-discipline. There is a control of the body. And so he goes into some illustrations. Verse 3, "Now if we put the bits into the horse's mouth so that they will obey us, we direct their entire body as well." Well, I know almost nothing about horses other than kind of what they look like. But I've seen, you know, I've never put a harness on a horse, but I've watched other people do it, and then I've, you know, use the reins to ride a horse, but basically, or if the horse went, it's where he went anyway, if I was on it. So I wasn't really using the bit to control them. So it is controlling the tongue there. And so, you know, in which if you've, like I said, I don't know much about horses or whatever, but there is a difference between, you know, when they just put the, you know, when you don't have the bit and bridle on, but you just have a bridle or just something that's, you know, around it, and you're pulling the head. Well, that has to do with how well the horse is trained. You're not obviously capable of making it do what you want there. You know, so
this goes back to when horses were primarily transportation plus work.
Yeah, it wasn't the recreation horse. Wasn't your pet. And so there's a difference there. So and you know, and if you see people that know how to ride, you know, they get on any horse and it does, you know, basically what they want it to do because of this. And then he gets to the next illustration. He says, look at ships also. They are so great and are driven by strong winds and are still directed by a very small rudder wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. Now, that one, while very few of us have been on, you know, actually giant ships or been able to, you know, to actually see them, we all have a concept or seen pictures of ships, and proportionally, even though the rudders on huge ships are huge, proportionally, that rudder is very, very small compared to that ship. And the great German battleship, the Bismarck, when there were a couple of things that I find just fascinating with that. When the Bismarck went out, the Allied forces that went after it, the ones that were there early were fairly, you know, the planes that were going were kind of the obsolete things that were going after it. Not by intention, that's just who showed up. And the Bismarck, its guns couldn't move slow enough. And so they had a hard time shooting these planes down because the guns were calibrated for a much, you know, more advanced airplane. And then, you know, with some of that, allowed a torpedo to hit the Bismarck, and it hit one of the rudders. And while the Bismarck would have been able to have gotten away, what ended up is the Bismarck could only go in a circle. And you know, and that was the downfall. So here's this giant German battleship that, you know, theoretically could have made a huge difference in the war, and the rudder, this little bitty part, proportionally speaking, was the whole thing.
And even modern ship technology, they use these little jets of water to
direct what's...
Yeah, so even though it's, you know, much more sophisticated than a rudder here, it's still the same
concept of...
It's a really small force that directs
this huge... And if you've ever been in a canoe or anything like that, you know that you're just... It's, you know, all you have to do is put the paddle in the water and just barely move it. Well, I'm just saying, if you have a stream, you know, if it's sitting still, it doesn't work. Or the other one, if you've ever been in a canoe and you're trying to paddle and you realize you can't get it to go anywhere because you just go in circles because you're, you know, you're sitting here going, hey, you paddle. And, you know, and if you don't know what you're doing and you get two people, then you're telling, you know, and you're telling that one, you know, paddle harder, and you're going to, instead of knowing how to turn it, because all you have to do, not that I can do it very well, but I do understand the concept finally after Rob and I spent an afternoon in the lake trying to get off the lake, you know. But you know, when you pull it in, you can turn, how you turn it is going to, you know, the person at the back is going to guide it. But anyway, that was one of those romantic getaways when you end up fighting out and like, just quit paddling. I'll do it. But that's, you know, so there's such a small part. Well, James is using that as an illustration then of that's what the body's like. And so he moves on in verse 5. He says, so also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. And, and that really is where this section ends. And then we'll pick up the rest of from following for the second part of this. But you can see his kind of the progression. And it's an interesting progression in that it starts with teachers, but then he moves into this part about the tongue. But the tongue has to do with a little bitty part controls. A little bitty part controls, you know, a 1,000-pound horse. A little bitty part controls this, you know, it's even true, you know, regardless of what age, very, very big ships. Obviously, our ships are a lot bigger than their ships, but you know, proportionally the rudders were very small compared to the ship. And, you know, the rider on the horse controls where the horse is going because of the bridle. The pilot of the ship controls where the ship is going because of the small rudder. And so here's the thing is, you know, are we controlling where we're going by use of our tongue, or is it's almost viewed here as it moves in, and yet it boasts is seeing the tongue as a you know, a separate entity almost, which obviously James wouldn't believe, but that's his, you know, the presentation is almost to see the tongue as it's, you know, it is what's in control, and yet that's almost what it seems like at times. You know, when you hear people, I was listening on the way driving over this sports talk show, and this one guy, they were talking about the matchup in the BCS Bowl games, and one guy was saying he liked, you know, they were talking about the Fiesta Bowl, and this one guy was saying, yeah, he liked it. He was glad that those, you know, kind of the mid, when basketball, they never call that in football, but in basketball they call them mid-majors, and you know, the non-BCS schools is what they call them in football. He was glad they were playing each other because if they play, you know, the BCS schools, if they win, it's a big deal. If they lose, then they go, well, nobody expected them to. So he was glad they were playing him. And this other guy said, well, you know, you would like the 15th century Europe when it had class systems. You just want people to be in the class and keep them there. And the other guy goes and says, well, people are always writing in saying I call people names, which I've heard him, you know, he thinks he doesn't, but I've heard him call a lot of people names. Listening, he says, and here you are, you know, you're just calling me a name. Well, technically, he didn't call him a name. He compared them. And, you know, you just, but you see, you know, obviously they're getting paid for it now. Afterwards, they're still friends, you know, all that, I would imagine. But, you know, but when you see that, here's this use of a tongue. Starts back and forth. You're trying to make an illustration, but the illustration gets really personal. Charlie Weiss, supposedly off record, but still trying to figure out why you'd even say this stuff off record. And I don't know if you heard this, but and I don't even know what he was really talking about. He was just sounded like he was just really frustrated and mad because he was, you know, didn't have a job anymore. But he was started talking to me. He said, anything I do here, I get scrutinized over. You know, everybody's just on top of me evaluating everything. And, you know, if I, and I guess he got in trouble for some profanity he used. And so he'd make that, and he said, but if I lived on the West Coast and I, you know, was shacking up with somebody, and I don't exactly how it was worded, but it's clear implication, if not stated, that it was the coach of USC. Well, you know, why are you saying that? And then he comes back and says, well, it was just an illustration. You know, I wasn't trying to play. And, you know, but that's what happens. You know, we're get frustrated, and all of a sudden that's controlling everything. And the, you know, which we're all aware of, we've all been there. You know, you just cannot go back in time and take those words back. You know, by his positioning, even though when it moves on with the tongue, we quickly think of the kind of illustrations I just gave, that where we're being negative, where we're saying words we shouldn't say in the sense of that they're profane, or we're saying hurtful words. That's kind of what we think of here. But with Paul's introduction, I think it needs to be broader than that, because he's talking about teaching, you know, and so there's that sense of How does it impact people? Whether or not it's, you know, hurtful or profane, what are the things that you can say that weren't even in those categories but yet aren't beneficial? You know, the passage in Ephesians is a very intriguing. Chapter 4 in Ephesians, just a really interesting wording in about verse 27, 28, somewhere in that area. Paul is in really, there's this kind of transition occurs in verse 25, and he says, therefore, laying no, that's not where I wanted. In 24, where he's made this, and so he says, and 23, and you be renewed in your spirit and mind, and put on the new self, which in the likeness of Christ has been created in righteousness and holiness of truth. And then he says, therefore, and he starts giving these kind of put off the old, put on the new, which is what he was talking about earlier about. We need to, in verse 22, that, you know, lay aside the old things, put on the new things. And so he says, the first is lay aside falsehood, speak truth. 26, be angry and yet do not sin. 27, which I think goes with 26, do not give the devil opportunity. And then 28, don't steal, but rather give to people. And then 29, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment. Reason, so that it will give grace to those who hear. I remember one time speaking on this, and a guy afterwards said, so it's not if you don't have something good to say, don't say anything, but if you don't have anything good to say, find something good to say. You know, because it says, you know, that we should be speaking words that build up, that meet the need of the moment. So, you know, when we talk about the tongue in James, I think all of my immediate attention goes to all the negative things we shouldn't say, refraining from the negative, which, you know, is a major thing. But surely there is this other part, you know, saying the, you know, as this passage was saying, things that meet the need of the moment, and which would fit the idea of teaching. So teaching isn't just not saying the kind of negative things, but teaching would also be, you know, being prepared to not say the wrong things, but it's also saying the things that, you know, are positive and build up. So anyway, that's where James takes us at this point. He moves on with it and makes a little broader application, you know, as it has to do with the whole body, the whole person, and but with James, this idea of a tongue being in control, and obviously it's not the tongue as a organ in the body's in control, as though this dualism, you know, I'm not in control, I can't control my tongue, or you got to control it, you know. It's either the tongue or it's my mind over here. But it's that aspect, that's almost what it's like with people. You know, they have no control. The tongue's in control. And he's saying that's what we can't have. Well, any thoughts, insights?
Well, this is a very different application, but as you were talking about this, I was reflecting about my work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my jobs is negotiations. I do a lot of negotiations, and I really don't like that part of my job, but that's part of what I do. And I'm told by others that I'm actually very good at it. And I was telling this to me today that my secret is I don't say anything. I mean, that's my approach when I go into negotiations. Is I'm
awkward silence.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the last negotiation I had was with Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. And, you know, they asked, say, so we can have a bigger discount? There was this long, long, long pause. And finally someone else spoke up and from Wyeth and, like, that question addressed to, and so I mean that's a very different application, but it's still part of this, you know, not idle chatter and not just you know.
That's what I was thinking when you said, like, you know, my mind was always like, try to decide if it didn't need to be then.
Oh, wow.
And the internet. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And even this one, which you're kind of like, why is it there and why do I care? You know, why do I want to hear? But what, Tiger Woods' mother-in-law fainted or whatever, and they called 911. Well, 911 calls are public, evidently. So that's, you know, so that whole thing is played on these sports talk shows, and it's like, why? But from what I, you know, what little bit I heard of it, you know, it's like, you know, it's really nice that for her that, you know, she's been very calm. And but, you know, I mean, what if you weren't, or what if you were upset, or, you know, I mean, it's, yeah. So, but those are the ones. Now, should that be made public? No, that's another issue, I guess. But I don't know why I have the right to know a 911 call myself. But yeah. But your point of everything is out there, yeah.
In verse 2, you know, kept sticking in my head was that you always hear about, you know, developing the capacity to control your thoughts or to your thoughts. You know, and here you said, you know, guarding your tongue is the thing. And at the risk of incriminating myself, I don't say nearly everything that I think anymore. You know, that was my problem when I was a little kid. You know, and
maybe
I was not saying everything that comes in.
And maybe there's a part of that, you know, if you get real idealistic, and you know, I don't know if that's a good term to use biblically, but you know, if you thought it, then it, you know, you already sinned. You know, if you get just super kind of that, it's like, you know, almost we, you know, where Jesus is, you know, basically if you hate somebody, then you've murdered them in your heart and stuff, like, you know, so this spiritual murder. But you know, there's a difference between spiritual murder and physical murder. I mean, so, you know, so Jesus saying the principle is, if you've done it, you know, if you've hated them, you've broken the commandment and you murdered them. I don't think by that, or I'm positive by that, he wasn't saying, so if you hate them, just go ahead and physically kill them, because, you know, and that's kind of how we almost want to take it at times. So that would be true here. So if you have, I want to say, but you don't, then you're in control of your tongue. So should you have had that thought? No, but... Were you able to not do that? Well, there's a certain sense of control there that.
Well,
that
it's
works.
Troubling because he says, you know, the one that controls his tongue is the perfect man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not the one who doesn't need to control his tongue.
Yeah. Well, I think there's I think sometimes, you know, in our view of spirituality, because I think we clearly can find in passage in Scripture where, you know, those thoughts, sin begins with that thought, and it, you know, and it progresses in that. But where is that point of where you cut it off? And does that have to do with maturity? Now, does that have to do? So we have to make that distinction between, you know, if we're talking about what pre-fall Adam would have done, that's perfection. Are we talking about maturity? And there's a difference. And remember, I was at this class when I was working my degree that it was for kind of ministers. What was the name? Something about their ministers' health or something. And yes, it was a lot. You know, it had a definitely psychological aspect or that approach to it. But this professor was talking in terms of that he gave an illustration that he had gotten a speeding ticket. And he was talking about the humiliation of being there on the side of the road and you're stopped and all, you know, everybody passing by and, you know, and so how that makes you feel. And there's that part of whatever it is, however you respond to that. And obviously he wasn't trying to promote, you know, well, if you just get a bunch of them, then you get used to it. But he was talking about there's a level of maturity is that, you know, when it happens again, that you don't have the same reaction. You don't feel, you know, all those, you know, all that, those negative things that, you know, that take you negatively in a wrong place. I mean, hopefully you still feel the same way about, oh, I don't want to get another ticket, but not, that wasn't what he's talking about. Well, you know, that's maturity. So there is that part of when we recognize something and we say it, I mean, even though I don't want to put this up in the level of maturity because I don't think I was being very mature at the moment, but, you know, when I didn't follow through with what I wanted to say to the kid, that's more mature than if I would have followed through with it. So there's a relative sense. And, you know, maturity is a relative term. And we want to use in, you know, Christianity, we want to use it in, you know, I believe in truth, and truth is absolute. That's there, and that has to do with truth. But there's still relative things. Maturity is relative.
Well, and there are different, particularly relational consequences to things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm a person that has lots of negative thoughts and hateful thoughts, even if I never say anything, you know, that's, you can perceive that. But if I go around saying all those things, you know, it's, the consequences to the relationships around me are greater than if I don't say those things.
What's the, and not an application of you, but it's just the phrase, what's the deal about saying something, you know, removing, about being, you know, removing, you know, speaking, and therefore you remove the doubt that you're stupid or what. Yeah, there you go. And so I wasn't trying to say you're a fool, but that would be the application of what, you know, that kind of that phraseology. Yeah.
The other application too is I remember speaking to somebody who was newly married, and I asked him about something
they'd
argued about, and I said, you know, Eric and I still argue about that. We just argue differently.
Yeah.
It is definitely a progression to a better type of argument, but at the same time.
That's a good illustration. I'm glad y'all are able to say that. I'm glad to know it works for some people. Remember one time when Megan was so, I don't know, so they were little. They were little, and Robin and I were not being very great role models, or I probably wasn't being. But we were arguing, and the girls were back in their bedroom or back in the other part of their house, and I didn't even realize it. I was probably just reacting to, it was getting louder in the house, so I was probably just, you know, getting louder myself. But finally Robin pointed out, said, do you realize what song is on? But Megan was playing some Amy Grant song about love, and it just kept getting louder and louder and louder. So they weren't happy with us arguing. You know? But, yeah, I mean, you know. Well, there are prayer requests.